Welcome to Chemistry of the Mind, unlocking the brain's secrets. We're diving into the fascinating world of neuroaesthetics.
It's a relatively new field, right? Trying to understand the brain's response to beauty, art, music.
Exactly. It bridges the gap between subjective aesthetic experience and objective neuroscience, coined by Samir Zeki, pretty recent, actually late 90s.
So like how our brains react when we see a beautiful painting or hear a moving piece of music.
Precisely. It delves into the neural processes behind appreciating and even creating art. It's a truly interdisciplinary field, pulling in neuroscientists, art historians, even artists themselves.
I see. So it's not just about I like this, but why we like it, neurologically speaking?
Yeah. And it even touches on the evolutionary basis of aesthetics, the idea that
that our appreciation for art and beauty might have, you know, survival value?
Right. Like, maybe our ancestors who could recognize patterns and appreciate visual harmony were better at finding food or shelter or...
Choosing a healthy mate. Makes sense. It's fascinating to think about beauty as a survival tool.
It is. And then there's the big question, are there universal laws of aesthetics? Can we pinpoint specific brain regions or neurotransmitters responsible for aesthetic experience?
Is that where computational neuroaesthetics comes in? Using like machine learning to predict what people will find beautiful?
Yes. It's a powerful tool for analyzing vast amounts of neuroimaging data and trying to model aesthetic preferences.
Huh. So we could potentially quantify beauty? Put a number on it?
Some researchers think so, though others are, well, understandably skeptical. It's a pretty complex experience to reduce to, you know, algorithms and brain scans.
But even if we can't fully quantify it, understanding the neural mechanisms involved could be incredibly valuable, right? For things like art therapy or even just appreciating art on a deeper level.
Absolutely. And there's a lot of research looking at specific brain areas like the reward center and the default mode network, which interestingly is also associated with daydreaming.
Oh, so there's a connection between appreciating art and letting your mind wander?
Potentially, yeah. And there's also work being done on how different art styles are processed differently. Abstract versus representational, for example.
I can see how those would engage different parts of brain, like recognizing objects versus interpreting more abstract forms.
Exactly. And there are theories about how certain visual elements, like lines, colors, contrasts, activate our visual system in ways we find pleasing. Ramachandran's laws of artistic experience are a good example of that.
Right, those focus on things like peak shift, grouping, and contrast. I remember reading about those. Pretty intriguing stuff, although...
Although a little reductionist, perhaps? Like, can a set of laws really capture the full complexity of artistic experience?
Yeah, that's my concern, too. It seems like there's always more to it than just, you know, lines and colors. The emotional context, the artist's intent, the cultural background.
Definitely. And that's where the debate between bottom-up and top-down processing comes in. Are aesthetic judgments driven by basic neural responses or by higher-level cognitive processes?
It's probably a combination of both, right? Like, we have these innate preferences for certain visual features, but our experiences and knowledge also shape how we perceive art.
Most likely. And that's what makes neuroaesthetics so complex and so fascinating. It's a field that's constantly evolving as we learn more about the brain.
It also raises questions about, well, the very nature of beauty and art. If it's all just neurons firing, what does that mean for the artistic experience? Is it less meaningful or...
Or just understood in a different way. That's a question philosophers and artists have been grappling with for centuries, and neuroaesthetics is just adding another layer to that conversation.
And a very intriguing layer it is. It will be interesting to see where this field goes in the future, especially with the advancements in brain imaging and artificial intelligence.
So we've been talking about this fascinating field of neuroaesthetics, but it also makes you think about creativity itself, right? What even is it?
Well, that's a question people have been grappling with for centuries. There are tons of definitions out there, over 100, according to some estimates. It's a real rabbit hole.
Wow, over 100? That's a lot. So no easy answers then?
Not exactly. I mean, there are some common threads, like problem solving, generating novel ideas, making connections.
Right, like Torrance's definition, seeing a problem, searching for solutions, testing them, and sharing the results. Classic problem-solving approach.
Right, like Torrance's definition, seeing a problem, searching for solutions, testing them, and sharing the results. Classic problem-solving approach.
Exactly. But then you have someone like Gotz who focuses on the act of creation itself, regardless of the outcome. He separates creativity from originality, which is interesting.
Oh, so you could be creative without being original?
Hmm.
According to Gotz, yes. You could create something that's already been done, but the act of creation itself is still considered creative, though often they do go hand in hand.
I see. And how does innovation fit into this whole equation?
That's where the rubber meets the road, so to speak. Innovation is about putting those creative ideas into action, making them useful, having a real-world impact. Amabile and Pratt make that distinction pretty clearly.
So creativity is the idea, innovation is the execution. Got it. It's like the difference between writing a screenplay and actually making the film.
Precisely. And then there's emotional creativity, which is a whole other dimension. It's about originality and appropriateness in emotional experience, how we express and process emotions in creative ways.
Interesting. It seems like there's a whole spectrum of creativity, from everyday problem solving to groundbreaking artistic achievements.
Absolutely. And the way we view creativity has evolved significantly over time, too. Ancient cultures, like the Greeks, didn't even have a concept of creativity as we understand it today.
They saw art as discovery, not creation. Plato even denied that painters made anything, saying they merely imitated.
Right. The idea of creation was reserved for the divine. Humans were just conduits for divine inspiration, whether through the Christian god or the Greek muses.
So when did this shift happen? When did humans start seeing themselves as creators?
It was a gradual process, starting in the Renaissance with the rise of humanism. The focus shifted to the individual, the great men, and their abilities, like Da Vinci. But it really took off during the Enlightenment.
That makes sense. The Enlightenment was all about reason and individual potential, so imagination became a key element of creativity around this time?
Exactly. Thinkers like Hobbes and Duff started emphasizing the importance of imagination and linking it to genius. Then in the 19th century, with the rise of Darwinism, the study of individual differences, including creativity, really gained momentum.
And that led to more formal study of creativity in the 20th century, with people like Wallace and Guilford developing models and tests. Hmm.
Right. Wallace's five-stage model, Guilford's work on convergent and divergent thinking, these were major milestones. And then you have the Torrance tests, which are still used today, though they have their critics.
It's amazing how much research has been done on this seemingly intangible concept. From Wallace's stages to computational models, we're starting to understand the mechanics of creativity.
And it's not just about the cognitive processes. There's the emotional side, the social context, the cultural influences. It's a complex interplay of factors. And we're still learning.
So we've been talking about creativity, but what's the connection between creativity and mental health? It's a complex area, right?
It is, yeah. There's been a lot of research looking at the link between creativity and certain mental illnesses, like bipolar disorder.
Right. I remember reading about a study where a significant percentage of authors were found to have mood disorder, something like 43% having bipolar disorder, which is...
Much higher than the general population, yeah. And there's the work of Kay Redfield Jamison, who also found a strong correlation between creativity and mood disorders.
It's fascinating, isn't it? This idea that there might be a link between the highs and lows of bipolar disorder and the creative process.
Anthony Storr, the psychiatrist, talked about creativity as a way of coping with depression, a way of regaining a sense of mastery. It's like...
channeling those intense emotions into creative expression? Yeah, I can see that.
And people with bipolar disorder often report heightened states of perception, increased emotional understanding, greater empathy, all things that could potentially fuel creativity. It's like...
Their brains are wired differently, allowing them to make connections others might miss. But it's not all positive, right? There's also the...
The darker side, absolutely. The symptoms of bipolar disorder can also be detrimental to creativity. The difficulties with interpersonal relationships, the substance abuse, the risk of suicide.
It's a double-edged sword then. This potential for both enhanced creativity and significant challenges.
Exactly. And then there's the question of how this connection works, neurologically speaking. What's happening in the brain?
Well, there's research suggesting that certain neurotransmitters like dopamine and norepinephrine play a key role in both mood regulation and creativity. It's
like a delicate balance. Too much or too little can disrupt the creative process. It's interesting how different parts of the brain seem to be involved too. The frontal lobes, the temporal lobes.
Right. The frontal lobes for idea generation, the temporal lobes for evaluation and editing, and the limbic system with its dopamine pathways driving the creative urge. It's all interconnected.
And then there's the role of sleep, especially REM sleep, in consolidating memories and fostering creative connections. It's like...
like our brains are reorganizing information while we sleep, making new associations that can lead to creative breakthroughs. It's amazing.
Hmm.
It is. And there are so many other factors that contribute to creativity, too. Personality traits, social and cultural influences, even economic factors. It's a complex interplay of elements. And, of course, the work of Vandevert on the cerebellum's contribution to creativity.
So, we've talked about creativity and neuroaesthetics, but this information on neurotransmitters and how drugs affect them, it's a whole other level of complexity, isn't it?
It really is. It's like peeling back the layers of an onion. First, you have the aesthetic experience, then the neural processes behind it, and then, at the very core, the intricate dance of neurotransmitters.
Exactly. And the sheer number of neurotransmitter systems. Noradrenaline, dopamine, serotonin, cholinergic. It's a lot to keep track of.
Not to mention the trace amines and their modulatory effects. It's a delicate balance, and even slight disruptions can have major consequences.
Yeah. Like with Parkinson's, which is linked to problems with dopamine production, or schizophrenia and ADHD, which might involve dopamine imbalances.
Hmm.
And then there's the serotonin system, often implicated in depression, although the research there is more nuanced than initially thought. Still, SSRIs like fluoxetine are widely used to treat depression by increasing serotonin levels in the synapses.
Right. And glutamate, which seems to be involved in a whole range of mental disorders from autism to schizophrenia.
It's fascinating and a little daunting how these tiny molecules can have such a profound impact on our thoughts, emotions, and behaviors.
Absolutely. And then you bring drugs into the equation, and it gets even more complicated. The way drugs can mimic or block neurotransmitters, affecting synthesis, release, reuptake.
It's like they're hacking the brain's communication system. Cocaine, for instance, blocks dopamine reuptake, leading to that pleasurable high, but also potentially to addiction and depression when the drug wears off.
It's a double-edged sword. Like with morphine, which mimics endorphins to relieve pain, but can also be highly addictive.
Hmm.
And then there are the drugs that block neurotransmitter receptors, like the antipsychotics used to treat schizophrenia. They're essentially jamming the signal, which can help alleviate hallucinations, but also have other side effects.
It's a constant balancing act, trying to find the right drug to target the specific neurotransmitter system involved in the disorder without causing a cascade of unwanted effects.
It really highlights the complexity of the brain and how much we still don't understand. But the research is promising. As we learn more about these intricate systems, we're getting closer to developing more effective treatments for neurological and mental disorders.
And not just treatments, but potentially even preventative measures. If we can identify the specific neurotransmitter imbalances that contribute to these conditions, we might be able to intervene earlier, before the symptoms even manifest.
Exactly. And this research also underscores the importance of lifestyle factors like diet, exercise, and stress management, which can all influence neurotransmitter function.
It's all interconnected. The brain, the body, the environment, it's a holistic system. And understanding the role of neurotransmitters is a key piece of the puzzle.
It is, and it's a puzzle we're still actively piecing together. But with each new discovery, we're gaining a deeper understanding of the amazing complexity of the human brain and the incredible power of these tiny chemical messengers.
Well, that's all the time we have for today's episode of Chemistry of the Mind. Thank you for joining us on this exploration of the brain's creative spark. Until next time, keep those synapses firing. Goodbye, everyone.
Goodbye.